the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Are evangelicals rethinking the issue of divorce? That's the question raised in the cover story of Christianity Today. It is about divorce. It promises a closer reading of the Bible on divorce. It has led to a considerable amount of controversy in evangelical ranks. We're going to be talking about it. It reached the pages of Time magazine just yesterday. And that's going to be the topic of our discussion today. We're going to be talking about the biblical grounds for divorce. We're going to be talking about where evangelicals are on the question of divorce. And with me in the studio today is one of the sources cited in the Time magazine article, Dr. Russell Moore. And we'll be glad to get to that conversation in just a moment. And we'll be glad for you to join it by calling 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Are evangelicals changing their biblical understanding of divorce? And, of course, the related question is this: should evangelicals change their position on divorce? And we'll be getting to that in just a moment. Again, to call, just join the conversation by calling 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. First, to review some issues in the news, the Philadelphia Inquirer is reporting that the University of Delaware is halting its mandatory diversity program for students. It's a residence life program on diversity and cultural identity, but it's over because of a student uprising. Students complained that they were pushed to accept the university's political views and to answer embarrassing questions about their sexuality. The president of the university, Patrick Harker, said that there are questions about the program's practices that must be addressed, and there are reasons for concern that the actual purpose is not being fulfilled. The program was stopped immediately, and the furor erupted on the Newark campus after parents, professors, and students contacted a Philadelphia-based advocacy group about the program that teaches cultural identity, diversity, and get this, environmentalism for 7,000 residential students. There's also a freshman orientation workshop that had been called Whole New World. The group, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education, known as FIRE, had taken the case with the argument that under the First Amendment, state institutions have no right to impose mandatory ideological training on their students. Now, I think any way you look at it, this is a significant development. It's the only case I know of like this where a university has recognized that it's in big trouble with a sexuality and morality indoctrination program required of all residential life students here, all dorm students and the freshmen in their own component. Now, one of the most interesting aspects of this report is that the students and their parents complained that students were required to answer, and I'm quoting here, embarrassing questions about their sexuality. I want you to note something. This is the new trend, and you will detect that this is happening not only in this case but in others. Not only that, but in California, children, very young school children, as young as the second grade, are being asked embarrassing questions about their sexuality. In some situations, children are being asked questions about their parents in a way that is deeply subversive of parental authority and the integrity of the family. We also have a situation, a new controversy that is emerging in the field of pediatrics, where some pediatricians, under the advisement of their own professional guild, are beginning to ask children questions about their home life, about their parents, about how their parents discipline, about sexuality issues and all the rest without the parents sometimes even being present. This is something we need to watch, and I do take it as a signal development that the University of Delaware has halted this program. Of course, it doesn't mean that the threat of something like this goes away. It could very well that it will be back. It looks like the new dorm program promised by the university will be floor by floor, a smaller group of students, and is going to deal more with, and this is what the paper reports, moving in and moving out, anxiety over tests, welcoming new students, and socializing with floor mates. Now, that sounds like what a freshman orientation program ought to be dealing with, not embarrassing questions about sexuality with a politically correct indoctrination to go along. At my website at albertmohler.com, you will find today an article posted on Denise D'Souza's book, What's So Great About Christianity. I entitled it, An Argument Against the Atheists, and it has to do with Mr. D'Souza's argument that the main complaint of these newly aggressive atheists is not against the intellectual credibility of Christianity, but against its moral constraints. He calls it a pelvic revolt against God. I think it's a very important argument. I think you will want to look at it. And again, you can find the article at my website. You can find his book at your local bookstore. Yesterday, we dealt with Gary Wills and his argument over abortion. But you'll also find at my website an article that is entitled Back to Polytheism, with a question mark. Some moderns see monotheism as a menace. This goes back to an article published in the Los Angeles Times, written by Mary Lefkowitz, who is professor emerita at Wellesley College. Interesting, Wellesley College, one of the liberal women's colleges in America, and perhaps safe to say one of the most liberal. Mary Lefkowitz makes a fascinating argument. She gets right to the point by arguing that the idea of monotheism, and this is her word, poisons human life. She suggests that we go back to polytheism. She holds up as a classicist Greek polytheism and suggests that that should be our model. Now, you know what she's going at here. The insinuation is that if you believe in monotheism, only one God, a belief, we might point out, that is central to Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, then you're going to have to worry about and argue about which God is the one true and living God. And that's going to lead to conflict, and that's going to lead to controversy and argument, and it just might lead to strife and worse. Of course, the bottom line is the fundamental question, is there only one God? Her argument's entirely pragmatic. Her argument's entirely that we could just get away from all these messy little religious spats and doctrinal disputes by just going immediately to embracing Greek polytheism. All those gods and more. Let the new gods come. Now, she suggests that polytheism is really, on the Greek example, much to be admired because there aren't these messy questions about truth. Furthermore, the Greek gods were never understood to be perfect. They weren't understood to be morally always upright. After all, they got drunk and involved themselves in sexual excess and all the rest. Well, the bottom line is, I don't think Americans are going to follow her argument. But I think it is fascinating to note that we have the new war on monotheism launched in the pages of the Los Angeles Times. I don't worry that Americans are going to all of a sudden decide let go of Christianity and worship Apollo and Zeus. I do think that it's a sign of where the cultural elite is. If you need further evidence for that, look at Stuart Hampshire's book, published by Princeton University Press, in which he suggests that monotheism is a threat to democracy. Then you can look at a literary figure such as the cousin of Jacqueline Onassis, Gore Vidal, who argues that America is threatened by what he calls the people of the sky god. And he suggests also that monotheism is a big problem. Gore Vidal is one of America's most famous men of letters, and he is a man with political influence as well. And so there you look at it, and you've got three now major figures in the press amongst the academic elite, the cultural elite, arguing that the real problem now is monotheism. As for Britain, a major think tank there says it should be recognized now as no longer Christian. Kevin McCandless reports that the Institute for Public Policy Research in Great Britain says that church attendance is now so low and the British Empire is now so dissolved that the Christian heritage of Britain is now so distant that it ought to be recognized as a secular country. Bishops of the Church of England should no longer sit in the House of Lords. The Constitution should now be a written document that declares the separation of church and state. Now, this is my favorite part of the report. It says there should be a new national holiday. Get rid of those Christian holidays. There should be a new national holiday to celebrate, quote, Britishness. That's really interesting. The philosopher Roger Scruton says that when a society reaches this kind of redefinition, it's really lost any coherence whatsoever. The culture is dissolving into nothing. As the British would say, it's turning into a total pudding. And that's almost what you see happening in this debate in Great Britain. It is clear that insofar as this think tank is looking at the statistics, the numbers do tell the story. There are few people in British churches. The church attendance rate's far less below than 5%. You're really looking at something like 2-3% of Britons attending church on a regular basis. 27% of Britons in a recent survey said that they did not even know what historical event was claimed to be behind the observance of Easter. They didn't have any acquaintance with the resurrection of Jesus Christ at all. Not even in terms of what they would reject. They simply didn't know about it. Well, I have no idea if the Institute for Public Policy Research is going to make headway in Great Britain in their suggestion that the nation should declare itself secular, but I do know this. Europe and Great Britain are turning themselves into a secular continent and Britain into a secular island, whether they declare itself that way or not. The big question, of course, is where this leads, because secularism never lasts for long. Like nature abhors a vacuum, so does the soul. That's why so many commentators are suggesting that if the Christian heritage of Europe is truly gone, it will quickly be replaced by a resurgent Islam. Back to talk about whether evangelicals are or should change their position on divorce and remarriage. This is the Albert Miller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. The cover story for the October issue of Christianity Today is about divorce. When to Separate What God Has Joined is the cover title. The subtitle, A Closer Reading of the Bible on Divorce. The cover article is written by David N. Stone Brewer, and it has to do with a rereading of how we should understand the Bible on divorce. I will not share with you the entirety of the article. I think the important thing to look at here is that he suggests a broadening of the acceptable categories for divorce. Now, in the evangelical world, traditionally, divorce has been understood as allowable only in the case of sexual infidelity. And he expands it here, arguing that he's expanding it on biblical grounds to include not only adultery, but emotional and physical neglect and abandonment and abuse. He argues that we should reread the specific words of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount and understand that what Jesus is talking about here is that he's against what we would now call no-fault divorce, but that he accepted divorce on a larger number of grounds. David Van Beem of Time Magazine wrote about it yesterday. His article is entitled, An Evangelical Rethink on Divorce? One of the sources cited in his articles, our own Dr. Russell Moore, Dean of the School of Theology here at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and frequent guest host of this program. Dr. Moore, welcome.
Good to be with you.
Now, let's just look at the basic argument. Before we get to the Time Magazine article, let's look about the Christianity Today piece for a moment. Mm-hmm. The argument being made by this author, Mr. N. Stone Brewer, who teaches, by the way, at Tyndale House at Cambridge University, he argues that we have read the Bible, the New Testament in particular, too restrictively on divorce. Any credibility to that claim?
Well, not particularly given the fact that his view is entirely novel in the history of the church. I mean, most Christians for the past 2,000 years have seen the so-called exception clauses as being very, very restrictive, something that would exclude almost all divorces that take place in our churches right now. And one has to wonder, why in the world is this kind of reinterpretation happening now? It's because we're living in a divorce culture that celebrates the impermanence of marriage.
Well, that's absolutely the case. And evangelicals are shifting on the issue of divorce, if not through formal teaching, then through the actual practice and breakup of so many evangelical marriages. You know, I have been contacted by so many in the press in recent weeks simply because of some of the most notorious of these, and especially some in the charismatic wing of the movement, where you have some very highly publicized divorces and some serial remarriages. And the issue of divorce is, let's face it, very hot right now in our cultural conversation, because conservative evangelicals, looking at, for instance, the likely front-running candidates on the Republican side of the presidential ticket, are looking at people who, at least many of whom, have had divorces.
That's right. And in their churches, they're sitting around people who have been divorced and remarried, sometimes several times. And you often have pastors who are hesitant to speak about the issue of divorce, except in very vague terms, because you have people in the congregation that often pastors are honestly scared of those people.
Well, it's the fear of man that really leads to a lot of this. And I want, before we even get much further into this argument, to go back to the bigger argument about what marriage is. And I think one of the things we have to recover as evangelicals is the fact that, marriage is, after all, a covenant. It's not a contract. It's certainly not a mere contract to be negotiated and to be kept so long as both parties think they're getting adequate consideration for their investment. It's instead a covenant. It's a covenant made not only before human observers and witnesses, but it's a covenant made before God. And God's plan for marriage is that marriage in its integrity, in its beauty, in its holiness, would reflect his own character. So what we see when we see evangelicals, Christians, messing up marriage is that we're actually lying about the character of God.
Lying about the gospel itself. When Paul says that marriage pictures Christ in his church, when you have someone who is unfaithful to his wife, leaves his wife, a wife who leaves her husband, is preaching a false gospel. That's one of the reasons why this is so devastating to the next generation. It's not just the psychological effects, it's the gospel effect. They're seeing a picture of a Christ church union being dissolved right in front of their eyes. Is it any wonder that it's so difficult for them to believe in a Christ who actually saves?
And who saves sovereignly and keeps his promises.
That's right.
In the sense that this is a covenant that he makes in his own blood, the New Testament says. It's not a revocable covenant.
That's right.
It's not a hypothetical covenant. It's an actual covenant made with his bride, the redeemed. Now, Russ, when you start looking at this article in Christianity Today, I think it requires comment on several levels. Number one, the fact that it appears. Interpret that. I'm going to offer my own understanding, but I would love to know what you think it means that the article appeared.
I think it means that you have evangelical churches now that have shifted from a view of divorce that at one time there was clear preaching and teaching about divorce as a sin, that moves into preaching and teaching about divorce as a tragedy, now is moving into preaching and teaching of divorce as therapy. So that we at one time would have seen divorce as a church disciplinable action that would have involved the entire church community. Now it's really just its own special Sunday school class. You're now in the singles again class. And it's not seen as something that is sin. It's not seen as something that is a tragedy to the community. I think Christianity Today is reflecting that and saying we've got to rethink our view of divorce, because this isn't the way that we're living in our churches.
Well, it isn't the way many people are living, but I want to come back to this idea of the culture of niceness and the fear of making moral judgments and spiritual judgments. You know, that's the task of the church, is to deal one another compassionately, to deal with one another with compassion and with truth. And you really can't have the one with the other, without the other, that is. You really can't have truth without compassion, unless you're just throwing the truth at people in anger. But you really can't be compassionate without telling people the truth. And people who have experienced a divorce know there is sin involved. They know there is horrible tragedy involved. They know there's horrible brokenness involved. The last thing they need from the church is dishonesty.
That's right.
What they need is forgiveness of their sins, and to be made right with God. And divorce is not the unforgivable sin.
That's right.
But it is a sin.
That's right. And as Jesus says to Nicodemus, if you can't trust me in earthly things, how can you trust me in heavenly things? That's exactly the same thing with pastors and leaders in the church. If you can't trust me to tell you the truth about this matter, then how can you trust me to tell you about how to find your way to eternal life? It's pastors who are saying something that they believe the congregation wants to hear, or more often, just not saying things that they believe are going to cause a stir.
It's a very interesting introduction to the article here in Christianity Today. The author, again, is David Enstone Brewer. This is what he says. He cites Matthew 19:9, whoever divorces a wife except for sexual indecency and remarries commits adultery. But then a few paragraphs later, he says this, but does this literal text mean what we think it does? While doing doctoral studies at Cambridge, I likely read every surviving writing of the rabbis of Jesus' time. I got, quote, inside their heads, end quote, enough to begin to understand them. When I began working as a pastor and was confronted almost immediately with divorced men and women who wanted to remarry, my first response was to reread the Bible. I'd read the biblical text on divorce many times in the past, but now I found something strange as I did so again. They now said something I hadn't heard when I read the rabbis, or before I read the rabbis. Now, let me tell you my big problem with that, Russ, and you really alluded to this earlier. The people who would have heard and read this text first in the Gospel of Matthew would be the very people who would know about what the rabbis had said.
Mm-hmm.
How is it that they didn't get what this research fellow in the 21st century at Cambridge thinks he's got?
He's a little smarter than they were, I suppose.
Well, I think the problem is that when you're proposing something the church has never seen before, here's a hint. It's probably not there. And certainly on something as important as the issue of divorce, and something that's been as central to the church's self-understanding of the gospel, and of marriage, and of family, and of church discipline from the very beginning. Love to know what you think of all this. We're going to continue the discussion. To join, call us at 877-893-8255. I'm Albert Moeller.
Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmoeller.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Moeller.
Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. We're talking about evangelicals and divorce, and this is a hot topic, a sensitive topic, but it certainly is a relevant topic. It's the cover story of Christianity Today, and the furor over that article, much conversation, led to the attention of Time magazine. Now, when the issue ricochets from Christianity Today to Time, we better take notice. The big question is, are evangelicals changing our position on divorce? To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. On the line, calling from Phoenix, Arizona, listening on XM170, is Paul. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, Dr. Moeller, I appreciate your program. I listen to you often, and I am a divorced man, and I was a Christian when I divorced, and I do realize it was a sin. I'd kind of fallen away from the Lord, and when I read that article, I must admit I was looking for a way to find remarriage, and I still struggle with it, and I have been dating, but am in a celibate Christian relationship, getting counseling, and I guess my bottom line question is, what is your feeling and belief on what the Bible teaches about divorce and remarriage, understanding that it was a sin for me, and I do struggle with this because I want to do the right thing, I want the truth. And it isn't a very emotional and a difficult thing for me personally.
Well, Paul, I can hear that and understand that, and that makes me doubly appreciative of the fact that you called. And I'm glad to answer your question. I think it's one of those questions we always have to be ready to answer if we're going to deal honestly with the issue of marriage and then the issue of divorce and then the consequent issue of possible remarriage. I believe that what we find in the New Testament, in Matthew 19 in particular, is one ground, acceptable ground for divorce, and that being sexual indecency. It's not just adultery, that's the main meaning, but sexual indecency. And on that basis, which is a violation of the one flesh relationship, I think it's very clear that Jesus, not saying this was God's intention, but as an understanding of the crucible of living in a fallen world, a world of sin, he says that God allowed this exemption through Moses. So I believe that is the only exemption. Now, I have never performed a wedding ceremony for a person who has been divorced. And the reason for that is, even as I accept that exception language, I think it's clearly addressed to the church. It's clearly addressed to God's redeemed people through Christ. And the context for adjudicating this, that is for making decisions about this, should be the local church. Only the local church, through its process of corrective and edifying church discipline, can understand what really has gone on in a marriage and in a divorce, and can decide whether there was indeed a legitimate ground for a divorce. Now, if there is, let's be real clear about this. And Paul, this is, I think, what's in the direct background to Jesus' statement here. If there is a legitimate divorce, then at least one party has broken the marriage covenant. And thus, that one party in a Christian marriage is guilty of sexual sin and needs to be dealt with in the process of being confronted with that sin and through the entire process of church discipline. So, Paul, if I was in a situation in a local church where I knew that a legitimate, sustained, responsible process of church discipline had taken place and moral judgment had been made by people who know both parties and knew the marriage and know the circumstances, then I would say divorce, clearly in this case, may be allowable. And remarriage then might be allowable, but only with the judgment of the church, with a sustained and legitimate process of church discipline. I can just tell you, in all my years of ministry, I've never seen that. I'm not saying it doesn't take place, I'm just saying that I have never seen it. So that's why I've never done this. I do not believe that the argument put forth in this Christianity Today article is legitimate. That is to say, I don't believe that there are additional grounds for divorce. I think there are additional grounds for corrective church discipline. And when we come back, I'm going to be talking with Russ Moore about the Time Magazine article, because it deals with this very question. I know, are there additional grounds? What about an abusive spouse? And I'm going to argue that the answer to that is church discipline, not, and that means an abusive spouse being called to account and to corrective action, not just leaving the marriage. Paul, I really do appreciate your question, and I'm going to have to refer you the same way I would anyone else here to your local church. I just hope and pray you're in a gospel-believing, Bible-preaching local church that really does practice all that the New Testament calls for in terms of restorative and corrective church discipline, and that's where you're going to find the best counsel for your situation. I can't and wouldn't do moral counseling or pastoral counseling over the airwaves, but I can tell you that I think that is the sole exception found in Scripture. And I hope you'll find some good Christian folk in your local church to help you think that through in order to be faithful. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. As I said, this issue is controversial. The cover story in Christianity Today was suggesting a broadening of the possible grounds for divorce. This led to some controversy in the magazine. David Neff and the author of the article both posted extensive explanations of the article and what they had meant, both by writing it and by publishing it on the blog at the website at ChristianityToday.com. But Time Magazine's picked up some of the controversy over it. And by the way, so have some other evangelical authorities. Dr. John Piper, pastor of the Bethlehem Baptist Church in Minneapolis, and also a frequent guest on this program, wrote an article in which the title really says it all. It's this: Tragically Widening the Grounds of Legitimate Divorce. Now, this is an interesting argument, and John Piper's onto something here. And you can find, by the way, this article at his website at desiringgod.org. He says something that I agree with about the article. He says this: to put it bluntly, the implication of this article is that every marriage I'm aware of could have already legitimately ended in divorce. And I do think that's the problem, because if you're talking about happiness in marriage and you're talking about satisfaction, you're talking about support, both emotional and material, you're really into a ground in which people are going to be claiming that they're not supported the way they need to be supported, or they're alienated emotionally and all the rest. And, I mean, where does that start? And, more importantly, where does it end? Russ Moore is my guest here in the studio. Dr. Moore?
And not only is there a widening here, you think about even the exception that Jesus gives does not mean that one necessarily ought to divorce in that situation. The church comes into the situation in which there has been sexual immorality. There ought to be an attempt at reconciliation. This is a final, persistent refusal to repent on the part of the spouse who is in rebellion. And so it's not even the language of exception is often misunderstood. This isn't a, well, now I'm free to get out of this marriage. It's always a working toward reconciliation.
I want a Time Magazine article for just a moment. David Bambima has written it, and he really does cover the waterfront in terms of evangelical life, which I appreciate. He talks about the controversy over the Christianity Today article, and he brings you into the article.
Mm-hmm.
He says this: many conservative evangelicals remain uneasy about divorce. If a split itself is inescapable, notes Christianity Today editor Andy Crouch, quote, remarriage is where the rubber meets the road, end quote, and many remarried couples find themselves denied church membership. Says Russell Moore, dean of the 16.3 million member Southern Baptist Convention's influential Southern Seminary, quote, we teach our future pastors that marriage is a lifelong one flesh union, end quote. Explain that.
Well, the situation is we're training pastors to go into churches in which the culture around them sees marriage as something that exists until there's unhappiness, until there's some type of incompatibility. And marriage instead is, as we've already said, a Christ church union. That has to be seen from the very beginning. That means that you have to have pastors who have to understand how to do marriage premarital counseling, have to understand who to perform marriage ceremonies for, and then how to intervene in crises as they happen within marriages, to try to keep those marriages together.
Now, if we had someone listening over our shoulders here,
mm-hmm.
from from most of church history, the fact you'd have to define marriage that way and then explain it would be considered bizarre.
Absolutely. But everybody in any of our churches right now has seen divorce up close. And the more that you see divorce taking place, the more it seems normal, the more it seems commonplace. I mean, frankly, many pastors right now are trying to negotiate how to deal with Thanksgiving this year because they're going to various step families. There's divorce everywhere.
Yep.
And so it just seems normal to our people.
Well, let me get to the divorce everywhere thing for a moment, because I have a point of personal pique.
Mm-hmm.
And irritation in this Time magazine article,
mm-hmm.
because it mentions the fact that evangelical credibility on this is compromised by the fact that evangelicals are divorcing at or above the national level.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me be the first to say that if there was even one illegitimate divorce, it would be a scandal for the evangelical church,
mm-hmm.
And there are millions of them. And we deserve every bit of moral censure that David Van Beeman, Time magazine, can give
mm-hmm.
to us. Just one little statistical point here, though. One of the reasons why evangelicals divorce at or above that national average is because we also marry at or above the national average.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's one thing to look at here, is that the rate of marriage is actually so much higher. So that leads to a higher divorce rate. But there's still no excuse. The scandal
right.
is still there.
That's right.
Now, in this particular article, in the very paragraph we read, you were asked about what should happen if a woman is in an abusive marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason David Van Beeman asked that is because in the article in Christianity Today by David Enstone Brewer, he suggests that emotional and physical neglect or abandonment and abuse
mm-hmm.
Should be understood as legitimate grounds for divorce. What say you?
Well, I think that one of the things I said to David Van Beeman is that that is not something that you can answer in a soundbite, because you have to ask what, first of all, is abuse. Oftentimes you have people who will use that word in a very vague, therapeutic kind of a way. I want to say, when I'm talking about abuse, I am talking about physical mistreatment. I'm talking about real harm being done. Not, as one man said to me one time, I want to leave my wife because she's abusive. And I said, well, what do you mean that she's abusive? And he said, well, she won't do this and that and the other around the house. I consider that to be an emotional form of abuse. Well, that's completely illegitimate. I want to see a church that investigates and says there has been abuse taking place in this marriage. And the first step is making sure that you protect vulnerable wives and children. And so you ought to counsel a woman who is in an abusive situation to immediately leave that home, have people within the church who are willing to take her in, care for her, and notify the authorities. This is a 1 Corinthians 5 church discipline issue and a Romans 13 arm of the state. Dealing with
I think it's very clear that we need to point to the fact that we believe that women who are in an abusive situation
need
should get out of
Absolutely.
That situation.
They
are morally obligated to protect
Absolutely.
Themselves and their children, and they are certainly not under any obligation to be at risk and
That's
to
exactly
leave themselves
right.
at risk of an abusive husband or anyone else.
That's right.
But that does not mean that that equals divorce as an easy calculation and an easy way out. This is where the intervention needs to get to the basis of the problem. And again, that's why the church is the indispensable entity here. You
mm-hmm.
can't get around the fact that Christians are not equipped to make these decisions individually or as individual couples. It was never intended that way.
And the church declares at the beginning, this is a marriage. The church ought to declare at the end, this is a situation that can't be salvaged.
Yeah, well, you know, I've gotten in a lot of trouble by suggesting that I find it scandalous that people come to the church to get married, then they run to Caesar to get divorced.
Yeah, that's right.
But that's the way it works. Back with final thoughts in just a moment. We're talking about divorce and American evangelicals on the Albert Miller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. The issue of divorce, it is something like, in response, what happens when a bacterium lands in the human body, all the white blood cells come out. And that's kind of true. When you raise this issue, all of a sudden, ears perk up. and people are afraid. You're going to talk about my life. You're going to talk about my sister. You're going to talk about my mom and dad. You know, what happened in chapel this morning here at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary was unexpected. But we had Jimmy Scroggins, the dean of Boyce College, who was preaching about bitterness. And the most telling illustration he gave to me of bitterness is when he says, as a dean of an undergraduate college dealing with the 18 to 22-year-olds, he says, many of them are bitter because they've seen their parents break their marital vows. Mm-hmm. And I was just so struck by that this morning.
And I think you can see even 30- and 40-year-old people who are saying the same thing. They've seen parents who have abandoned their families and split apart and divorced. There's just wreckage everywhere in all of our churches with this.
You know, I think one of the things we need to make clear here, Russ, is that that there is a way to look at the divorce issue that doesn't just leave, and we must not just leave it with its sin. We have That's to point right. to the redemption that comes to sinners through faith in the Lord Jesus Christ.
That's exactly right. And a divorced person who is restored to the fellowship of the church is not a second-class Christian, not a second-class church member. It's a restored sinner, just like any of the
Because the whole
of
church
us.
Is made up of
That's
people
right.
who are
That's
sinned
exactly
and saved
right.
by grace.
That's exactly right.
But you know what? The most important thing about that is that Christ has saved us from our sin, and it's impossible to know what he has saved us from if we're not honest about what sin is.
That's right. And sometimes it means pastors saying, you may hate me for saying this, but this is what Jesus says. He also says, I love you and I'll receive you into my family, but I'm going to tell you the truth.
And I have many dear Christian friends who are divorced
mm-hmm.
and have been divorced. And most of us know of this even in our families. Now, there's hardly a family untouched by this. But I think the worst thing that can possibly happen in this culture of civility and niceness is for pastors and for Christian leaders to say, you know, if I talk about this, it's going to hurt someone's feelings. If you don't talk about this, you're raising a generation that doesn't know what marriage is and doesn't understand what's at stake.
That's right. You have five-year-olds on that church pew who are watching what's going on in that congregation, and it's going to have ripples out for generations to come.
You know, it makes me think of Bill Cosby's new book in which mm-hmm. he talks about the fact that there are entire blocks of children in America where they've never witnessed a wedding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sad thing is there are an awful lot of evangelical kids in Christian academies and all over the place who, unfortunately, have seen a divorce.
That's exactly right, and often many of them.
This is a conversation that will continue because it's an issue that isn't going to go away, but it is a question of the church's faithfulness and of our witness to the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. Back tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday. You're listening to the Albert Miller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.